tonight's talk is on taking risks, death and dying and transformation. And next week's talk is going to be on joy and happiness, taking risks and transformation. So as you can tell, I have a slight cold. So if for some reason it's challenging to hear me, just go like this. I understand. So I'd like to see, with a show of hands, anyone who has not experienced a death in their life. So just look around the room. Okay. So we all have been there. Understanding death is also looking at impermanence and how that affects our life. So I'm going to start with this poem and then tell you a story. Here today, gone tomorrow, a gray hair falls onto a white page. Me reading the sign and the symbol, not many days left in my personal calendar. And that's by Robert Leverant. So I've had more than my share of deaths in my life. And most recently, between November and last week, there's been over seven losses. But I'm going to tell a story about a loss that was a few years ago. When I was in graduate school, there was a group of women, and we had a graduate support group, and we were quite a diverse group. We all had nicknames. I don't think I should tell you my nickname, because it's going to be recorded, but you have to promise not to use it. Okay, there was a woman in our group called Miss B. Then there was a woman in our group called Sparky, like after a dog, and she would go woof woof. That's another story. And then there was Cecilia, and we called her Cece. And then I had this nickname that Miss B gave me. Okay, here we go. Shasha. So Cece is mixed race. She was Hawaiian and Caucasian, and she grew up in Hawaii. And she wasn't the youngest of the group, but she liked to boss me around. And I didn't have a big sister, so she was my little big sister. And Cecilia embodied a bodhisattva. And she came from an impoverished background. But she created, we had this, every 6 weeks we would meet, and we would always do something fabulous. So one time we did mud baths up in Calistoga, and we had a gourmet meal at midnight, because she was determined to do it right and her way. Mind you, I'm the first one to sleep. But I woke up for the meal, and it was fabulous. The mud bath, that's a different experience. I'm telling you, you only need to go through it once. And we would stay at different hotels. And so I got to really enjoy being at these places, because it's out of my comfort zone. And so all of us would put our money together and we would do this. And I remember one time we had dinner on the bay. And I was sitting near the window and I was watching the water. And they were like, "Are you all right?" And I said, "No, I think I'm getting seasick." And they're like, "You're on land." And I said, "But the water's moving." So we had a lot of wonderful conversations, and we were very supportive of each other. Cecilia even talked me into, we wrote a grant, and we were able to get funded, and we went up to Calgary to an indigenous an education conference where we were in teepees. Between the dung and the buffalo burgers and the wild horses, it was a wonderful experience. Mind you, I got lost. And she was looking for me, and it had everybody on the land looking for me, and it was funny. So these are just stories about her, so you get to understand our relationship. She also was on dialysis, and she was on the list for a kidney transplant. Well, she did get that, and it was the first time since I'd known her where she was not in pain. And for anyone who's had surgery or been in pain and they're no longer in pain, you forget to be careful. Because it's so wonderful to be able to move. Oh my goodness, you're just like a whole new person. And I know because I've had a few surgeries, so I've learned over the years to be careful. But the first couple, I was like a fool. Anyway, she was in heaven, and it was lovely. It was lovely to be with her and to know that this had happened for her. And then I don't know if she, her body started rejecting it or whatever, but I got a call from her mom, her grandmother, and she told me that she's in the hospital and she's dying. And would I come? And I was honored to be asked, because for her family to see me as family was an honor. So I go to the hospital, and she's in ICU, and her grandmother's there, and two other friends, and so we're all around her. And her grandmother, so we do a vigil. So the doctors said that they need to make a decision. She needs to make a decision within the next 12 hours. Mind you, she was like almost in a coma, and it was probably the last stages. That was a hard 12 hours. And at the end, her mom decided it was time for her to go. So there was a pastor or someone, chaplain, and she kicked him out the room. That was funny because she felt he wasn't really helping. So then there's a group of us all around her, and we each touched a part of her body, and her grandmother leaned over and told her she could let go and that we would bury her at sea like her father. One of the traditions in her culture is that you share breath, and that was something she did with me on different occasions. And I was like, I don't want your mouth on mine. And she was like, girl, please. But it was an honor, and it was a sharing. And what she wanted to do was to be cremated, and then her ashes taken over the Pacific near her home. So her mother said, well, it's time for you to go. We'll let you go. So we all just had our hands on her body, and she just took a big sigh, and she just left. So I was a little in a shock, to say the least, and I had to call everybody else in my group. Miss B refused to believe it, and I was like, Miss B, you think I'm gonna call and say a joke like this? And she's like, no, I know you wouldn't. It's just I'm in shock. And Sparky lived in Oregon, and so we were all in different places. So in the memorial service, she was raised Catholic, but she also embraced different traditions. And so I was asked to do something related to Buddhism. So I started. I was like, oh, what am I going to do? So I looked at Tibetan book on death and dying, and I was like, oh honey, no, that's a little much. And so one of the women in our group, our cohort, an African-American woman, she sang Amazing Grace, And then there was a priest, and he did something. He said a prayer. And she was teaching at a community college. And she's very much into her roots and identification with that. The entire football team, that was mostly Samoan young men, all showed up for the ceremony and did a dance. It was beautiful. And so I wasn't sure what to do. And so I decided I would do a mental prayer. And so I invited everyone just to hold their hands open or put their hand on their heart. And we did a metta prayer. And it was quite lovely. So my experience of losing someone was buffered with such a sweetness in the way her culture and tradition and her family let her go. And it took a while to accept that she was gone. So that was maybe over 10 years ago. And then for those of you who have your best girlfriends and you go on road trips or your best guy friends and you do things together, I'm fast forwarding. You have a good time together. And I had just come back from a road trip with a friend of mine to, where did we go? Oh, North Carolina or something. And she has a heart condition and I have a heart condition. And she's a nurse. And I figured, well, she's a nurse. We're both on meds, we're fine. So we took this road trip. But we flew in and then took the road trip. So we weren't crazy to drive from here all the way out, not made it. So it was great. It was a great trip. We both have grown children and we're talking about our future and what we're gonna do. And she got back in November. We got back in November. And we were going to go down to Santa Cruz to see a mutual friend and hang out. I got a call from her housemate. And she told me she died of probably a massive heart attack. I think I went into, you know how you can deer in a headlight and you see these headlights and you're like, oh my God, what's going on? I didn't know what to feel. Because I had just talked to her, and she just lived, like, in Oakland. So that seemed like the domino for others to happen. And then my girlfriend's niece went into the hospital. She had seizures on Christmas Day, and she was 13, and she died. And then my daughter's first boyfriend, his stepdaughter, committed suicide, and she was 16, and she hung herself. And then one of a dear member in our sangha in the East Bay, he had surgery and stuff, and I knew that he was going to have complications. He requested that I come see him before he passed away. And I didn't realize it was going to be so quickly, but the next day he passed. So when I was there, we did metta together, and he kicked everybody out the room. And I was like, you can't do that. People came to see you. He's like, you're here. No one else matters. It was so sweet. And then he passed, but he was prepared. And then my girlfriend, remember I told you my friend died? Well, her housemate, her mom died in January. And then I checked in with a friend of mine back east who had been taking care of her mother. And the day I called, after she got off the phone with me, her mother died. And this was last week. So it's like, whoa, what is happening here? And Larry Rosenberg says, living in the light of death, there are a few things you might want to remember. Mm-hmm. Everyone must die. The remainder of our lifespan is decreasing continually. Death will come regardless of whether or not we have made time to practice the Dharma. Human life expectancy is uncertain. There are many causes of death. The human body is very fragile. Our wealth cannot help us or save us. Our loved ones cannot help. Our body cannot help. And yet, we want to hold on to living. And as I experience these different losses, both close and far away, the ones that not moved me the most, but it seemed like it felt so tragic with the children. For whatever reason, the young woman committed suicide, and then my girlfriend's niece with seizures, like, they're babies. So I think it's because I'm a parent, and I think about what if it was me. And I can't imagine that my daughter would go before me or my grandchildren. So it's hard. And when I was thinking about this topic, I didn't want to make it all doom and gloom, because part of what happens in this process is that the Dharma is alive in the sense of how we live with impermanence. Can we be with impermanence and be with this is what it is right now? So every moment's precious. Even when we're arguing or frustrated or not feeling heard, there's also the potential for liberation and transformation. So some of us who take care of our elderly parents are single and have no children or no partners, and family members aren't exactly running at your door to help you. So in the case of the most recent death, my girlfriend had the good fortune to be able to have her mother at home, but it was quite expensive because she had all the care for her, and she had different people coming in and just spending the time with her. Now all of that's gone. She doesn't have anybody who's taking care of her mom, because her mom's passed. The people who would come in would also prepare meals for her and clean and everything, and part of that was her own family, extended family. And so now she walks around the house and it's empty, and it's quiet, and it's silence, and she's alone. And she's having a very difficult time. And right now, different people are flying in and calling and inviting her to stay. So she has ways to get through it. And then she said to me, but what happens when everyone goes and I'm alone? And this is our practice. Because we're always alone, whether we realize it or not. It doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't make it any easier. So there's the sadness, there are the memories, there is what's going on right now. And the question is, who's really dying here? Is it just the person who took their last breath? And what about the person who's taking care of them? So there's death there as well. There's transitions. And yet, there's an opportunity for transformation and liberation. Because any of us who have taken care of anyone watches the body change. We can see it in ourselves. Sometimes I'm not feeling looking in the mirror, except how do I look to go out the door? And this is my body, and it's not my body. So how do we hold that? How do we hold that with kindness and with care? I know that in the teachings of the Buddha, especially it was done for the monks, where they take the 32 parts of the body, and they described it in such a way that some of it sounded really vile and offensive. And I think that was because there was a way to not become attached to the body and not become attached to glamour. And yet, here's the paradox. I love my body, and I'm doing the best I can with it. And yet I'm trying not to hold on to being attached. And because I've had different health issues, there's a way that my attachment is a little different. It's like, it would be great if this body was like 100%, oh, I can do all these different things, and it's not. So herein is an opportunity to practice impermanence. Can I be with the aches and pains and know that this is impermanent? This is my body and it is not my body. And yet, it is imperative to take care of it. So if we're really looking at seeing things as they really are, then we're not with false hopes of being of anything unrealistic or any harmful desires. We're just with what it is. We're not because being with impermanence and accepting things as they are, we're not moving to this place of frustration or disappointment and despair. And yet they come and they arise. Like when I want to do something and my body's saying, go ahead, I dare you. I don't think so. So if I try and my body's like, what did I tell you? It's like, oh yeah, I forgot. So it's also important to be aware of your limits and be kind to yourself with that. So the various stages in the life of a person, childhood, adulthood, and old age, as we know, are not the same at any given time. You know, you can only run after a 2-year-old for so long, and you're like, oh, honey, it's time for you to go. You know, you can get your exercise in like that, and you're like, okay, sweetheart, can you come in? Nope. And then they run further, and it's like, oh my goodness. And the child is not the same as they grow up, and their understanding of impermanence is very different. They can't handle 2 minutes. It's like, that's a long time. And you're like, oh, if only you knew. And we also know that nothing remains the same for any consecutive moments. And the Buddha implored us not just to talk about impermanence, but use it as an instrument to help us penetrate deeply into reality and obtain liberating insight. And going back to the story about Cecilia and her being a bodhisattva, she was always giving birthdays. She'd come out with all these different gifts, and she always knew what to give you. And her mind was really like sharp, and we would have these arguments and disagreements, and she was a wonderful teacher. And so it was like, when I look back now, I am so grateful she was in my life, because even though I lost her physically, her memories and the things that she taught me stay with me. So even when there's a physical loss, the being is gone, the memories can be tools of transformation. You can think about your relationship, or you can think about when you fought, because we had some fights. Well, actually, disagreements. And look at what they were about. Just shake your head and say, I still love you. I disagree with you, and I still love you. And then all these recent deaths for me, it's like it's helping me really understand how precious each moment is. this is all we have, is this moment. I teach first through sixth graders mindfulness through expressive arts. And this is in the inner city of Richmond. And so some of these children have experienced some pretty hard things. So they'll tell you, life's not fair. And I'm looking at them, I'm like, you're only in the fourth grade. Well, life's not fair, so you might as well get used to it. And I'm like, wow, okay. But what I appreciate is how they can be with the moment, as harsh as it can be in their life, they can find joy and be happy. And so I see them as a reminder of this is also so precious. And if you look deeply into impermanence, you will do your best to make her happy right now, or make yourself happy right now. Because of being aware of impermanence, you can become positive about it, loving and wise. We have a lot to offer young people, even if they don't want to hear it. Like my grandson, he's 16, he says, I'm a man, and I'm like, you're what? How old are you? Well, man, I have the voice. I'm like, and? You know? And my granddaughter just turned 20. And I said, well, I call her my diva. I said, so what's the diva going to do? Oh, I have no idea, Nana. So it's sweet to be around that kind of lightness and that kind of freedom or freeness in terms of just being, you know, the sun rises and sets on them, and that's it. And we know it doesn't. And it's not something I want to take away from them, because life will give them their experiences when it's time. Here's a wonderful poem by Rumi that helps hold this in another context. It's called Kiss the Ground, for those who know it. And for those who don't, well, enjoy. Keep walking, though there is no place to get to. Don't try to see through the distances. That's not for human beings. Move within. But don't move the way fear makes you move. Today, like every other day, we wake empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. The preciousness of each moment. So one of the things I teach the children is when we understand mindfulness, we're always present. So if you're worrying about the past and the test that you just took, it's done. And if you're worried about the future and the test you're about to have, you're setting yourself up. So what happens if you just be with right now and do the best that you can? That's going to help you prepare for the test and not the worry, although you're going to worry. There's something about appreciating the preciousness of life, because it also helps us appreciate the preciousness of death. And how to make it meaningful is that we can reflect on the fact that death is certain. We understand that. And that the time of death is uncertain. So I might not see you again. So then this moment is so precious, and that's what we have. And it's kind of scary. When I said that, I was like, ah! And yet, that's what it is. One of the things, all these, another lesson that I'm learning is I feel an urgency now to put my affairs in order, just because I don't know. And I was talking to my mother about it, and she's like, I don't want to talk about it. I said, no, Mommy, you don't have to, because you're in a nursing home, and everything's taken care of. I said, but I do. And I know I'm not trying to make you feel scared, but I just know with all the recent losses for myself, I don't want to leave my daughter hanging with unfinished stuff. For those of us who've been through this, we know our families can give major drama, or you hear about drama, and it's unnecessary. And it's so sad, because it adds to the suffering, and it adds to those moments of, I just want this to be of ease, and people are acting like a fool. And you're like, you know what? But then you're like, oh. So grief shows up in so many different kinds of ways for people. So some of the things that we know about reflecting the time of death is uncertain is that we know the duration of lifespan is uncertain. Young people die, babies die, and then some people live forever. Like I think my mother will probably live for a very long time. Her sister's in her 90s, and I'm like, oh my goodness. And there's and that's joyous, and at the same time it's a little scary. And there are many causes and circumstances that lead to death. But how do we favor the sustenance of life? How do we take the teachings of the Dharma and be with it in the moment? So when someone says, it's really good to see you and you look great, I take it at face value. I'm not going to even read into it. I'm like, thank you. How are things? Oh, honey, I don't need to tell you about that part. But thank you for seeing me, you know? I was raised where it could be, all kinds of drama could be going on at home, but you all look good. Because you don't need to have everybody all up in your business. At least that's how I was raised. It's like, it stays home. You know, so you can't really tell by looking at me unless I tell you. And I've actually found that that has been a refuge that I appreciate because it's given me strength to just be able to sustain in a sense with adversity. Our bodies can easily be destroyed by disease or accident. And understanding some of these factors, we can realize that life is short and precious, and there's no time to lose. And short is relative. When we have young children, we're not thinking of life as short. But as they're older, and we look at each other, and we see wrinkles, and different parts of our bodies don't work as well, and we've got to have those 8 hours sleep, and it's real important to move the body even when you don't want to move it, then we get to see life is precious and life is short. I have 5 brothers and 1 sister, and I can't believe that we're in our 40s and 50s and 60s. It's like, I remember when you were 5, you know? And you were beating me up. But now we're all older, and when we get together, we just look at around the room and see the next generation and the next generation, and it's like, wow, we have been able to live this long. So some of the things I think about are, am I ready to die? What unfinished business do I have? What do I want to do or achieve in the time I have left? Will my priorities change? What can help me at the time of death? Or as somebody put it, live each day as though it was your last, and one day you'll be right. Oh well. You gotta bring some humor to this, right? How you hold and understand death is also a doorway into liberation and transformation. Because it doesn't have to be this angst of avoidance, because that adds to our suffering, because we don't want to deal with it. And I think this society, Western society, really supports you in not dealing with it. They really cultivate aversion. And I notice that when I watch TV, advertisements, ads for women are about losing weight, skin cream, exercise. I mean, eating healthy is okay, it's great, but all the other things is like youth, 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 youth. And it's like, where is the wisdom and acknowledgement and appreciation for us as elders, as older people? And, you know, sometimes I think about it from different cultures and how some of that is held with such high regard, and that very much appreciated. I remember one time I was teaching at East Bay Meditation Center, and I don't know what culture she was from. I know she was of Asian descent. It was an older woman, and when she came because she has a business down the street, and she heard about us. And so she came, and I knew she had a long practice because of her culture. And when she bowed to me, I just was moved to tears. And I was like, no, I should be bowing to you. She's like, no, you're the teacher. And I said, no, but you're my elder. And so we hugged each other. And it was just lovely to be able to appreciate that about each other and the wisdom that she brings. So again, it's another poem. I like weaving poems in because they help say more than what I could possibly say, and it brings another understanding of the Dharma. Sacred wine. Sit with the pain in your heart, he said. Hold it like a sacred wine in a golden cup. The wine may break you, and if it does, let it. To be human is to be broken, and only from brokenness can one be healed. The ancestors say the world is full of pain, and each is allotted a portion. If you do not carry a share, then others are forced to carry it for you. And the suffering you bring to the world is your sin. But the suffering you bring to yourself will be your hell. Sit with the pain in your heart, he said, and hold it there like a sacred wine in a golden cup. And that was by Greg Kimura. And the Buddha says, every wakeful step, every mindful act is the direct path to awakening. Wherever you go, there you are. So this idea of exploring death and dying as a entryway into liberation or transformation is not something that I thought about right away. I mean, I was just thinking about all the losses and looking, like observing myself being numb every time I got another call and saying, this is getting a little too much here. And then noticing that I was shutting down, and how do I hold that? And then I was realizing that perhaps that I was getting afraid, that maybe some of it would rub off on me. You know, like, maybe I would die. Kind of freaked me out. And I was like, no, what else can I learn from this? Because I loved every one of them. I mean, for my daughter's first boyfriend, for us to still have connection, like family like that, is huge. And he called to let us know And that was so kind of him. And then when my girlfriend's niece passed, that was very kind of her to let me know. And then to ask to be remembered in prayers and to say prayers. It's like when we do the metta, it's to offer that to all beings. So it helped me to appreciate my practice a little more. Not in the moment, though. Kind of was like numb to it all. And then it's like, what do I say? What do I do? You know, it's like, okay, where does the etiquette come in? What do you say to someone? And yet you want to be there for them and be supportive and be kind and not say the wrong thing or not say anything at all. So it's an opportunity to practice. Ajahn Chah says, the Buddha told us to see the way things are and let go of our clinging to them. Take this feeling of letting go as your refuge. And then I was thinking, well, am I not feeling things because I'm on overload? And I thought, well, that's possible. That's really possible. And then I let myself really explore being afraid. Being afraid of dying. And I live with health issues, and this thing was like scary. Because I'm used to the health issues, because I've learned to adapt and handle my body. But sometimes when I think about death, I get afraid. And then I think, so where's my practice now? Like, come on now, hello, I need you right now. And it's not there, or at least I don't think it's there. And I wonder, the Buddha was brilliant in terms of understanding and exploring these issues, but I wonder sometimes if he wasn't afraid, you know? It's huge. And there's so many layers to understanding and exploring what death is about. It's not just the physical loss, it's loss. And when I think part of the reason why I shut down is because I didn't get an opportunity to just really slow down and just be with one person at a time. And you know, as well as I do, that when an experience of strife or hardship hits you, and you look at it, you don't get to just be with that one person. Everything in your life comes up. And I think that's why I kind of shut down, because it was like, I didn't ask for this. I didn't ask for my life, 60 years of my life to go by every time I looked, someone passed. And yet, it was an opportunity to say, oh, there's this too, and this too. And then what would it be like to lose my mother, or what would it be like if my daughter or grandchildren left before me? So I got to be with the deep sadness of that and just see what that was like. I'm gonna tell you, I don't like it at all. It's like, oh, I don't like this. And can I be with not liking that and not judging myself about it? Because I also got to understand is that I'm attached. So then how do I handle and hold attachment and understanding the Dharma? I'm still working that one out, so I don't have an answer for you. But I do believe that it helps me in some ways to let go a little more, because I've had experiences in understanding it in relationship to other people. And yet, I still am afraid, because it's not my child, or not my grandchild, or family member. And yet, there are many faces of death, and there's liberation with that. And can we be with the liberation of the sorrow? So this is the last one I'm going to leave you with. It's a little longer, but what I want to share in this is that I'm going to weave in and out of saying things with this, because this is a poem on hope. It is hard to have hope. It is harder as you grow old. For hope must not depend on feeling good. And there is a dream of loneliness at absolute midnight. I think we've all experienced some of that. You also have withdrawn belief in the present reality of the future, which surely will surprise us. And hope is harder when it cannot come by prediction, any more than by wishing. But stop dithering. The young ask the old to hope. What will you tell them? Tell them at least what you say to yourself. Because we have not made our lives to fit our places, the forests are ruined, the fields eroded, the streams polluted, the mountains overturned. Life is connected to life. Hope then to belong to your place by your own knowledge of what is that no other place is, and by your caring for it as you care for no other place, this place that you belong to, though it's not yours. This is part of the practice of the Dhamma, which is not to be attached, but to understand our interrelation and connection to everything, for it was from the beginning and it will be to the end. Belong to your place by knowledge of the others who are your neighbors in it, the old man, sick, and the poor, who come like a heron to fish in the creek, and the fish in the creek, and the heron who man-like fishes for the fish in the creek, and the birds who sing, and the trees and the silence of the fishermen, and the heron and the trees that keep the land they stand upon as we too must keep it or die. Again, life is connected to life. This knowledge cannot be taken from you by power or by wealth. It will stop your ears to the powerful when they ask for your faith, and to the wealthy when they ask for your land and your work. Answer with the knowledge of the others who are here and how to be here with them. By this knowledge, make the sense you need to make. We are models for each other. This is the practice of the Dharma. By it, stand in the dignity of good sense, whatever may follow. Speak to your fellow humans as your place has taught you to speak, as it has spoken to you. Speak its dialect as your old compatriots spoke it before they heard a radio. Speak publicly what cannot be taught or learned in public. This is also the practice of the Dharma. Listen privately, silently to the voices that rise up from the pages of the books and from your own heart. Be still and listen to the voices that belong to the stream banks and the trees in the open fields. There are songs and sayings that belong to this place, by which it speaks for itself and no other. And this is the earth that we walk upon. So found your hope then on the ground under your feet, your hope of heaven. Let it rest on the ground underfoot. Be it lighted by the light that falls freely upon it after the darkness of the night and the darkness of our ignorance and madness, because we all suffer. Let it be lighted also by the light that is within you, which is the light of imagination. By it you see the likeness of people in other places to yourself in your place. It lights invariably the need for care toward other people, other creatures, and other places, as you would ask them for care toward your place and you. This is the Dharma. We're connected to all life and all places. And we care. No place at last is better than the world. The world is no better than its places. Its places at last are no better than their people, while their people continue in them. When the people make the dark the light within them, the world darkens. And that's when there is suffering. And there is also freedom. And that is a poem by Wendell Berry. So, this practice of understanding our relationship to death and dying is one of liberation and one of transformation. So, oops, not so fast. Thank you for your practice and your teachings. Oops. Enough. Thank you. So we're going to have someone read about those we want to hold a special place in our heart for.
For David, who has been in denial about taking care of his physical body and is having his first serious episode of chronic pulmonary obstructive disease. For Joan, suffering from severe depression. For Linda, whose mom is 96 and moving into a new community. May Cheryl be healthy and have a peaceful recovery. May Susan's recovery continue, and may she have patience.
There's something wonderful about metta, because metta is a form of compassion to me. And Sylvia Boorstein talks about metta as being, well, not just metta, but the practice of the Dharma as being one of friendship, of kindness. So I kind of weaved my metta practice in terms of a compassion practice. So I'm gonna say some metta phrases, and then I'd like to do the dedication of merit. And I would like all of you to think of someone that you would like to offer metta to, along with the ones that were announced, whether it's for yourself, or someone you know, or a stranger. I invite you to open your heart. May all beings be protected from inner and outer harm. May all beings live with ease and well-being. May all beings love and be loved. And may all beings be free from suffering and its causes and conditions. So in the practice of dedicating the merit, we offer the merit of understanding and learning more about death as a doorway to liberation. So we offer this merit for the healing and liberation of all beings in all directions. without exception. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.